When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley and this is a very special episode where I'm interviewing Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary, live in Birmingham. So Matt, we'll come on to your day job later, but normally when I do these things, we've done them at previous party conferences, it's good to talk to the politician, but you know, the person and their background. So I wanted to speak to you particularly because everyone says they, you know, they want a backstory, and yours from the Tory party is extraordinary. You were privately educated and then you went and did PPE at Oxford. which will come in hugely useful when the inevitable leadership bid is launched. But just talk to us a bit about...
Anyway, it was really nice to see you.
Talk to us about your upbringing and where. I know you've talked before about, you know, growing up in a village and that sort of thing, but where did Matt Hancock begin?
Well, I began in an NHS hospital, like almost everybody else. I grew up in a family that was dominated by the small business that we ran. My stepdad wrote the code. It was an early computer software business. My stepdad wrote the code and my mum ran the business. So you can see who wore the trousers in our family. They built that business, and you know, it underpinned, I suppose, the values that I've got and why I've ended up as a Conservative, because they worked extremely hard and they believed in aspiration and the ability to achieve, you know, reach your goals.
And is that where you got the tech bug?
Well, yes. I've been a technophile for all my life. I love the gadgets, and I learned to code, you know, before I was at secondary school, I guess.
And what gadgets in particular did you sort of like playing with or using or whatever when you were a child?
Oh, that's a good question. I had one of those really early BBC computers.
And with a proper floppy disk.
Yeah, the 3.5 and the 5.25 floppy disks. In fact, there used to be an 8-inch one, even older than that. We had this guy who came and worked for. He was the first person that Mum and Bob employed, and he did a year for us. And in it, I remember he wrote a game for us as kids on the computer, and then he went and he left us. It was really annoying. He left after a year to join this obscure startup in Seattle called Microsoft. We couldn't understand what he was doing. And he said, they're hardly paying me anything. They're going to give me shares. And we thought, you're nuts. I think he was their employee number 25. So anyway, so yeah, I got the tech bug. And I've also, you know, that's where I learned the value of being of enterprise.
And was the business successful? Was it, you know, presumably, like with all business, there were ups and downs?
Well, yes, and there was one particular moment that really got me interested and led to the path of getting into politics eventually. Because I was, you know, I grew up, I was interested in the technology, I was also interested in the business. I was interested in how the business works, how do you make it successful. And then in the early 90s recession, when I was a teenager, there was a big client of ours that owed us money and was late in paying its bills. Still a big issue today with small businesses. We got to the point where if the check didn't arrive by the end of the week, then the business was going to go bust. We employed, 20, 25 people, and they would have all lost their jobs, and the house was on the line, and my mum and my stepdad obviously didn't, they'd put their all into this. And it was through no fault of their own. I felt this real sense of injustice that we could, it was a nervous time. We nearly lost everything. Thankfully, the check did arrive with 2 or 3 days to go, and the business was saved. And then somebody very helpfully invented the internet, it took off. And after that, things were more comfortable. But it changed me, because until then I was focused on how you do business, how you build a business, and that made me ask the question: well, how does the whole system work? How can a perfectly reasonable, successful business almost go under because of something completely outside their control? And that led me to be interested in economics, and then and study it, and then PPE kind of brought in the politics side. Went and worked at the Bank of England. And whilst at the Bank of England, I realised that actually all the big economic decisions are made in Westminster. So that's how I ended up here.
I ended up here. And what sort of student were you? Were you a hard-working student? Were you a sort of David Cameron, leave it to the last minute, essay crisis type student? Or
If I had my time again, I would have gone to more lectures. Because they were fascinating, and I don't think I appreciate it as much as at the time. It's such an extraordinary place. And I was more interested, I was very social. I was the social secretary of the college. When I was culture secretary earlier this year, there was a moment when suddenly I thought, I've gone from being the social secretary of Exeter College to the social secretary of the country. So I was more interested in sort of, college life and social and quite and sporty. I didn't do any politics. I was I had a great time.
And you've done an interview
that wasn't meant to be linked in quite the way they came out.
Two things very separate. There's an interview which is coming out this week that you've done with GQ where you've talked, I think, for the first time about the fact that you're dyslexic. And I was just interested in why. You felt you wanted to talk about that, and why you'd not talked about it before, and the impact that it's had. What impact has it had on you?
It's funny, I feel quite nervous about it. I haven't talked about it before. In politics, I didn't talk about it because it felt like weakness to talk about having a problem like that, which millions of people have. And I thought that the weakness of it sort of put me off, and people might look down on me because of it. But actually, the truth is, it's given me some real strength. I can't read as quickly as some other people can, but I can remember details and numbers and language. And I wonder whether that's partly because of it. And I thought, I took some inspiration from Ed Balls when he talked about having a stammer. And I saw what he did. And then I saw how people reacted to the fact that he talked about it. And other people came forward and then someone said, someone else who's dyslexic, who I didn't know for ages, was also dyslexic. We had this kind of moment. Oh my God, you're dyslexic! And we talked about how the workarounds that you have and the different ways that you have of looking at things. He really encouraged me to say something in public and to say, the message to anybody who is dyslexic. Is that you can achieve. You can achieve whatever you want to. Whilst it may make it harder to do some things, it makes you better in other ways. I mean, the research shows that people who are dyslexic make lateral connections more often. And actually, in politics, it's those sort of human and lateral connections that are often the more valuable ones. We've got a brilliant civil service who are brilliant at straight line thinking, and part of our job is to make the connections. Here I am. But God, I feel uncomfortable talking about it. It's great to get it, to be able to say things in public.
How can you, given that, I mean, I know, you know, even reporting on politics, there's just so much written material, reports, and
yes,
you know, you've got speeches and red boxes, and as in not my red box, your red box.
Oh, well, I've got red boxes. I've got your red box.
Of course, you've got your red box. But how do you just deal with all that sort of? I mean, other people who aren't dyslexic complain about just being swamped by that amount of reading and information.
Well, I care a lot about clarity. So, for instance, you know, the morning red box email from Matt Chorley is brilliant for clarity, and if you don't have,
well, that's all we've got time for.
And if you, you know, and so clarity matters. Actually, the best advice when it comes to inside the government, the best writing uses fewer words rather than more. Yeah. You know, I live by this adage of Mark Twain's that I didn't have time to write you a short letter, so I wrote you a long one instead.
Yeah.
You know, I'm quite clear with the civil service teams inside the government that they need to write with clarity and as much brevity as is possible. Yeah. Those long, long paragraphs of dense words, especially people using long words where a short word will do. You know, why do it? You know. I'm well supported. I've been well supported in the 6 departments I've been in by civil servants who are up for that. There's more that they can do. There's no doubt about that. Actually, outside of the formal government processes, you know, really good journalism is brief too. Really good journalism has clarity, and that helps me.
Let's talk about your 6 governments, but I'm not sure I can remember them, even though I've been reading up on your career.
Some of them have been dissolved.
They were so successful, they weren't needed anymore. All the problems were solved, and they could be shut down. So let's rewind a bit. So you were at the Bank of England when you were snapped up by George Osborne in your position to be his chief of staff.
Yeah.
And then you had this sort of extraordinary relationship with George Osborne, where for a long time you were pretty shackled to it. People said that you were, you know, incredibly close to him and loyal and, you know, maybe a mini George or whatever. And actually over time, was that a hindrance for a while, do you think? That there's sort of, particularly when you then became an MP and then became a minister, it was always reported as being, oh, that was a sort of Osborne request, or, you know, he's...
Oh, I see. It doesn't matter now.
Yeah.
The truth is that George... I worked very closely with George on the economic arguments that were the big arguments of the decade between the crash and Brexit. You know, that was the big argument of the time for a decade, and he and I thought very, very, very similarly and instinctively would have the same response. So it wasn't that we did... There was very little effort to be in exactly the same place, and... I'd know how he'd respond to it, to something. Funnily enough, I disagree with him on Brexit, and that's the big issue of the period that we're living through. And
in what way? Because you voted Remain.
I voted Remain, but I fully accept the result, and I want to get a good deal. I'm 4 square behind Theresa May, and that isn't entirely true of George. facing those economic challenges that we faced in that first parliament in coalition, we did as a government some extraordinary things and turned around this economy, and, you know, the record numbers of jobs I'm incredibly proud of, and the national living wage at the same time, putting, you know, the biggest pay rise for the lowest quarter, those paid in the lowest quarter in the economy, the biggest pay rise ever for the people earning in the bottom quarter. It's worth saying it again. It's a creating record jobs. Thank you very much. It was, you know, sometimes we don't, because the economy's going well and there's this politically more contentious issue of Brexit, you know, we don't talk enough about the fact that we turned that around. And I think you did a remarkable job at that.
In the early days, when you were more junior minister, you probably in Westminster had a reputation for being very confident. do you think that was a fair perception? Or actually, now that you've spoken about your dyslexia, do you think you were overcompensating?
Oh, then maybe I was. I don't know. I didn't feel more self-confident than other people, but people do say this to me. you look at the challenges coming down the track and you do your best, and that's all you can do. You know, somebody told me something very, very early on when I was in politics, I think probably before I was an MP, which is that if you go into politics to achieve a specific thing and you won't be happy until you've achieved it, that is an honourable course, but it can be a very frustrating course. If you go into politics to make life better for your fellow citizens and to serve your country, then instead of all the frustrations, what you see from the platform that you're given in politics as a backbench MP, as a minister in the cabinet, that is a massive opportunity. And I very much put myself in that second category. So I see the fact that I have been asked by the Prime Minister to be the health secretary as a huge opportunity to do what I can to improve the health of the nation. You do what you can. You can't do more than you can. You do your best and you throw yourself at it. And I throw myself, I'd say more optimistic than self-confident, yeah. But it sometimes comes out that way, I can see that. But it hasn't always been the case. With my dyslexia sometimes got in the way of this. In the 2001 election, I went and helped out in the Guildford seat. And the sitting MP, Tory MP, really nice guy called Nixon Torbin, he wrote the copy, he wrote his election address, and he asked me to mock it up into a leaflet. I pulled out this sentence, which I thought characterised what he really stood for, and put it in as a subheading, and it said, "I want to unite the community." I thought, great, pulled that out, uncontroversial. And it was only after I'd sent it to the printers, and only after they'd sent it to the Royal Mail, and only after it had landed on 50,000 letterboxes in Guildford, that I spotted that I'd written, "I want to untie the community." Anyway, poor old Nick lost his seat by 800 votes. he's forgiven me. As Jeremy Corbyn might say, I consider him a good friend. And actually, you know, about 2 weeks after that election, bumped into Owen Paterson, who I knew because I'm from Cheshire and he's next door. He said, "Matt, your political career is over before it's even begun."
Owen, bang on once again. one thing I think that changed, certainly in the sort of Westminster bubble, that changed the view of you was when Theresa May became Prime Minister. And there were lots of people who had been in the Cabinet, and she offered them other jobs that were not in the Cabinet. And they either decided to go and pursue other things or flounced off, depending on what the adjective you want to use. But you didn't. You went from being Cabinet Office Minister and you took essentially a demotion to being the Digital Minister in DCMS and sort of totally threw yourself into it in a way that I don't think quite a lot of the lobby even knew there was a Digital Minister until you sort of grabbed it by.
What are you saying about Ed Vasey?
Oh, well, he was always going on about the arts, wasn't he? He just liked going to the theatre and hanging out with people at the Brits.
I've got a great Brit story as well.
Come on then.
I nearly gave it in my speech. I decided it was too risque. I went to the Brits this year and I was late because of a vote in Parliament, and I turned up and I was sat next to Ronnie Wood. And I turned to Ronnie Wood, this is a true story, I turned to Ronnie Wood and I said, "I'm absolutely starving and I'd missed the main course." And he reached down into a bag next to his feet. I said, "I could do with a pick-me-up." He brought out a wrapped-up tin foil like this and handed it to me. I thought, oh, my God, this could be a career-ending moment. And I unwrapped it, and it was a baby bell. That's the rock and roll you get in DCMS.
But you stuck out, and you had a big part in the digital sector of the manifesto, which actually was one part of the manifesto, which
chapter five,
which survived.
Yeah, we're putting it into action.
The coming into contact with the voters.
Yeah,
and
I don't think most people got to chapter five.
No,
it's
exactly.
A brilliant chapter. Go and have a look.
it's like a Boris Johnson column. Nobody actually read it. They just let other people tell them.
Oh, I thought that was just me. I can't do 4,000 words.
You do wonder sometimes if he's read it. But anyway.
Was there anything in it?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. Really. You could have read one of the early ones. Then you became culture secretary and threw yourself into that. But even that only then lasted...
6 months.
6 months.
Yeah, so, I have this attitude, which is that if the Prime Minister calls you into Downing Street and asks you to do a job as a minister, that is a huge privilege. I mean, you know, it's absolutely extraordinary, the things that you can do from that position. And it's true that, you know, I was asked to go and see the Prime Minister in the House of Commons, which, if you don't know, during a reshuffle, is very bad news. Because they let people go in the Commons, because then it's all behind closed doors, and then they do the hirings and the promotions in Downing Street, because then you get to walk up Downing Street and have your photo taken. And so I went in, and the Prime Minister... it had been briefed to the journalist that people would be fired until 11 o'clock and then she'd start hiring people. And I was asked to go at 10 to 11. And I walked in and I sat opposite the Prime Minister in her Commons office. I looked up at the clock above her head and it said 5 past 11. I said, oh, it's 5 past 11, this must be good news. And she said, well, it depends how you react. I'd like you to be the digital minister. And I'm from a tech background, yeah. And I enjoy being a minister, and it's something I think I could make a contribution to. So it was all done and dusted in about 2 minutes. I accepted, and I loved it. It was absolutely fantastic being digital. There's so many really interesting questions in the world now that really need answers, and it's the sort of area that Britain can provide a global lead as well. You know, our ability to be embracing of the future, yet also making sure it's done in a sensible and moderate and reasonable way. You know, this is especially around the future of the internet. Yeah. You know, to be in a position where people can take you seriously when you give a speech entitled "The Future of the Internet," you know, that for somebody, especially from a tech background and from a business background, so suddenly the tech sector that I literally grew up in.
Yeah.
Was the sector I was responsible for looking after. It was brilliant. Had a great 18 months in DCMS.
And one of the hallmarks of your time now since you've been Health Secretary is how much technology seems to be informing your approach and the way you talk about it, whether it's, you know, a GP app that people can use instead of going to see their usual GP, or, you know, on the flip side, guidance. You were talking at the weekend about guidance for... proper public health guidance on how much you should be using social media and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Do you feel that actually, in a way, that the digital minister job slightly makes it seem like, you know, you've got digital and you've got phishing and you've got, you know, small business. Actually, digital is across everything.
It is.
Yeah.
And I'd before I was doing the digital minister job, I was in the Cabinet Office doing the digital transformation of government. So I've really spent 3 years of ministerial life driving the digital agenda. You know, my first job was solving the Y2K bug in COBOL. I mean, not the whole thing, just one bit of it. And there's a big advantage to the fact that the people who are put into the ministerial jobs are also local MPs, so they understand the effects of all policy areas on their area. So you're a generalist in covering everything. So you know things. But I also feel the tension that you go into a department, and if it isn't your background, you know, people are right to ask, well, what value are you going to add? And in health, I'm absolutely determined to improve how good it is to work in the NHS and in social care and the workforce side. And of course, you know, I'm grasping the policy areas like getting more money into prevention and social care reform that I just spoke about on the stage. But I hope I can add some value with my experience of the technological revolution. And I also understand why for a long time nobody in a leadership position, either politically or within the NHS itself, has driven the tech agenda. Because, you know, hospital IT is something that has led to a few people losing their jobs, and to Andy Burnham losing £10 billion, and it's been a disaster in the past.
And you talked in your speech about how the NHS is still the biggest
by fax machines in the country. I mean, fax machines, but actually there's a funny story about that, which is that that fact comes from a Labour Party FOI. They FOI'd every hospital in the country. And they, to find out how many fax machines there were, they did this when Jeremy Hunt was the Secretary of State. They released it by total coincidence into the weekend when I was appointed on the Monday. And I've used it as a motivating argument. So I just want to say thank you to John Ashworth and his researcher for doing all those FOIs and contributing to my party conference speech. The truth is, there's a huge way to go. We've learned how to do it in other parts of government, not by top-down imposition of a single solution, but also not by just letting individual organisations get on with it. Rather, we set standards of interoperability, of cybersecurity, and of privacy, and then you can buy whatever you like so long as it meets those standards. It's a working method that's been proven to work, and I've led projects with this method where it's worked. I've also led ones where it hasn't worked, so I've seen the sort of ugly consequences when you get it wrong. And I'm absolutely sure that this can revolutionise tech in the NHS.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's talk about a couple of things sort of in your intro. Explain how you see the idea of, instead of going to the GP surgery, using an app. How does that work? What's your sort of long-term, if you could pan out, and I don't even know, is it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Oh no, it's much, much sooner than that, and it's starting to happen already.
Okay.
So you can, my app, my GP is on an app, and I did that when I was in DCMS. Because my GP retired, and GP retirements is another issue that I'm having to deal with. But it's convenient for me; it works for me. You use the app, and you can either interact with the AI, with the machine, and it can tell you lots of things like, "I've got this symptom. What should I do?" Then you can escalate and have what's essentially like a Skype conversation with the GP. And if you need to see a GP physically, you can go and see one. But the absolute core point is that we should be using technology to make life easier for people, for patients, and also to reduce the burdens and the pressures on the professionals so that they can spend more time with people who need it, who don't want to use the technology. You know, the care always has to be available face-to-face, human-to-human. You can't and shouldn't get away from that, but you can provide better services in a way that people interact with, in the same way that I haven't been into a bank building for years and years, and it's hugely more convenient for me to do that on my phone.
So in the same way that we've seen high street bank branches closing, is there a point where the traditional doctor surgery, as we know it now, doesn't exist?
No, no. On the contrary. So I think we need more GPs as well as more technology. And the reason is that we need to spend more effort, resources, time on prevention in the community rather than people getting to hospitals. That's the only way to make the NHS sustainable in the long term.
And what about the use of data, which you've also talked about? There's a huge amount of data about where you can sort of map lifestyles and health outcomes in different areas.
Yeah.
And can you end up using that to sort of predict and then target treatments in different areas? I hope so.
So you can use data should be used to help to provide better healthcare to individuals.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you were, heaven forfend, late night, say, tonight, going to, if you were to pass out, Say after the...
It sounds like a threat, but anyway, go on. If I were to find myself mysteriously in the canal...
If you were to end up in the A&E here in Birmingham, at the moment, it isn't always the case that they will be able to find out from your record, even if they know your name, whether, for instance, you have a penicillin allergy. That could be a life or death piece of information that you might need, that they might need. And so first of all, data is all about improving care. Second, use of data can improve research and we can get better cures. I talked about that with the expanding the genomics project in my speech today. Really exciting cutting edge cures. And for the first time, a new technology that can reduce costs in the NHS. Traditionally, new drugs have come on, they've been more expensive. Technology has been a driver of cost, actually. These sorts of technologies can reduce costs in the NHS. That's good. And then thirdly, one of the areas I'm really excited about that Public Health England are doing a lot of work on is what I call predictive prevention. Right. So this is... I hope you like that new alliterative name that we came up with. And this is about saying that so far through history, public health has essentially dealt with populations as a whole. You know, the anti-smoking campaign on TV is targeted at everybody. But using data, both medical data appropriately safeguarded, of course, for privacy reasons, and using other demographic data, you can work out that somebody might have a higher propensity to smoke. Then you can target interventions much more closely to try to improve the health of the nation. So I think that predictive prevention in public health is exciting, but it's really in the foothills.
And is that sort of targeted like political parties or news organisations can target people on Facebook with messages, and you could do that with public health? Or is it identifying, we think you might get a letter in the post or an email or whatever saying we think you are at risk of...
Yes, it's more the latter. I mean, in theory you could do the former, but you want to do it very carefully because this is people's health. Now
suddenly going quick you might die on Facebook, that might set alarm bells ringing.
That's not really what Public Health England are into, But there's opportunity there. It's all got to be done very carefully. You know, this whole data piece, it's all got to be very careful. Ultimately, it's got to be based on people's consent. It's got to be based on high-quality standards of privacy. I think having fortunately, I spent 2 years of my life putting the Data Protection Act into force through Parliament. I apologise for all those emails you might have got last May.
Those of us who write emails are really pleased with GDPR. It was a huge success. Yeah. we don't want too many readers. It's fine.
Well, it was actually.
No, actually, it was fine.
Yeah, because you checked with people whether they actually wanted to receive your email, or whether you were just spamming them.
It turned out they all did, and so it was fine.
Really.
I was in one of the papers today about you setting new cancer targets, which it was said was going to be, could be announced this week. Can you tell us any more about that?
Well, there's a lot of work on cancer in the long-term plan that we're writing with the NHS. We've proposed a budget of £20 billion extra a year over the next 5 years, and there'll be a plan that comes alongside that, and tackling cancer is an important part of that plan. Now, what we're proposing to do is try to get earlier diagnosis of cancer, where you can actually use the sort of technology we were talking about. Because Britain is pretty good at treating cancer once it's spotted, but we still have higher deaths than our peers, than similar countries on the continent from cancer because we don't spot it early enough. So there'll be a lot of effort on that.
And on the £20 billion, I mean, you're probably the first new Secretary of State to ever arrive at a government department and find a £20 billion pile of money on your desk left by your predecessor.
I'm literally the first.
Yeah. And depending on what you do with it, you might be the last. But what...
Do you know something I don't?
No. Although we never know, do we? Anything could happen. There has been...
I thought this was going okay.
There were lots of... there were lots of demands already on the NHS, which that money is, and there were some people who say, even though it's a phenomenal amount of money, it's still not enough, there's growing demand on that.
Yeah.
Then there is the huge issue of social care.
Yes.
And, you know, there were concerns about, you know, funding for public health and
yes.
that sort of thing as well.
Yes.
Realistically, you can't go back to Philip Hammond and say, well, we've spent all of that on managing demand in the NHS. We need another load of money for social care. Or can you?
I want to spend as much of that money as possible on prevention rather than cure. I think that you can only really get a big switch out of the secondary and acute sector into prevention when the budget is going up. So this is an opportunity. Now, I'm acutely aware that last time there was a big increase in the NHS budget in the mid-2000s, a lot of that was frittered away. And the general consensus was that that didn't get the improvements that we need to see. And so I'm very aware of that. Now, there will be more support needed to stabilise the hospital sector, but ultimately I want to get as much as possible out into prevention. That's GPs, pharmacies, out into the community services and mental health services.
And how big, one of the big sort of stories which seem to be constantly bubbling just below the surface at the moment is the crisis in local government. Particularly shire councils, but you know, local government have taken a huge hit financially, and ultimately they are the front line in social care. And then if people end up in hospital, then your department ends up picking up. How concerned are you about the sort of stability of local government?
Well, I can see the pressures, in fact, you know, today's announcement of an extra $240 million to help with social care to get people out of hospital when they don't need to be in hospital medically. That's a response to these pressures. So I understand it. It's a conversation that it's an ongoing conversation with the Treasury.
Fruitful?
Well, it was today, yeah.
But yeah, exactly. You've got some
now. Lyndon Johnson once said politics is all about what have you done for me recently? I only announced the $240 billion an hour and a half
ago.
Oh,
that's gone. So. That's ages in politics these days. That's ages in politics these days. Just because, I mean, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but just on Brexit, how confident are you of if we sat down like this at Christmas, a deal would have been done and Parliament would have voted for it?
Yeah, I'm confident that's where we'll be.
What impact do you think it will have, Brexit will ultimately have on the NHS? Do you feel like the NHS is ready for whatever the outcome might be?
Yes, I'm confident that we'll get a good deal, and that deal will be good for the NHS.
Perfect. That's bang on message. Right. And finally, given you, like me, because my birthday is always during Labour Party conference, so you have to basically spend your birthdays always with essentially people from work. How? What are you going to do?
I like some of the people I work with.
Well, that's where we differ.
oh, they say charming things about you too.
It's normally during party conference season. It's some.
Oh, I see.
I tweet very late at night. I tell you, I hate in politics. Everyone, and that's because I have to go.
Thanks.
I have to go to three of them, and you only have to go to one. How do you, given your brief now? Yeah. How do you? What's
which
your,
other ones you go to?
Well, I went to the Lib Dems and the Labour.
Crikey, is that still happening?
Well, we. I'll be honest, there wasn't a lot happening, but I had some lovely fish and chips and we found a really good mini golf on the beach.
Excellent.
There was excellent fun.
You had a few exotic spasms, didn't you?
Good Lord. What's your technique for avoiding a conference cold? That was going to be my question.
Well, actually, I've had a flu jab. That's the answer. And who's got a flu jab? Who's had a flu jab, rather, this year? We should have done this before we started. We should have said, if you haven't had a flu jab, you're not allowed to ask a question. But then I didn't know whether you'd had a flu jab.
I've not had a flu jab.
Well, then it would have made this, you know, much more interesting. a flu jab. When are you having a flu jab?
When am I having it?
Yes.
I don't know. Have you got it with you now?
Is there a qualified nurse in the room? Absolutely.
There is,
fantastic.
Of course there is. There's loads.
This gentleman at the front is going to give you your flu jab. Okay, can we fix that up after?
Not now.
And everybody else can have the... So I had a flu jab, so that's why I didn't get a conference call. Have a flu jab. It's good for you, and more importantly, it'll help me not bust my budgets this winter.
And
if I said that with some feeling,
If only the Prime Minister had a flu jab last year, it could have all been so different.
I think she did a very good job in difficult circumstances.
Well, we all hope that it goes better tomorrow. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Matt. As this is a Times Red Box event, I obviously have to plug the Times and Red Box. You can go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox and you can have me sort of taking an amusing look at politics every morning in your inbox, and you can get all the access to the Times and the Sunday Times online as well. But this is it's been an absolute pleasure. Please thank Matt Hancock.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're all looking to make more sustainable choices. But making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. The twigs and leaves in your backyard aren't exactly comfortable. And while mud does perfectly contour the feet, it doesn't score high on the durability front. But thanks to Allbirds, you can skip all the backyard experimentation. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff, like research and testing to create shoes from natural, sustainable materials. And their innovative processes mean using less of the bad stuff and more of the good while making shoes unlike any other. Like the Plant Pacer, made with 100% plastic-free plant leather. The Tree Dasher, a running shoe made from eucalyptus tree fiber. And from sugarcane, they've made the Superlight, their lightest shoe ever by weight and carbon footprint. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're supernatural. Find your perfect pair at allbirds.com today. That's ALLBIRDS.com.